person gives up an organ and they still remain alive. The most common examples are, of course, kidney donors, where you can live with one kidney. So people can donate a kidney and while they're alive and stay alive. And the other, which is less common, but it can be done, is a live liver donor. You can actually give up a lot of your liver because the liver can regenerate with as little as 10 or 20%. So it is entirely possible for me to be a live liver donor to somebody else, and we will both walk out alive. It is also possible for a partial lung transplant as well. Again, hospitals are very reluctant to let parents be live donors for their children because they feel that the parent will not make an objective judgment. You know, it might be devastating to their health, but they'll want to do it anyway, etc. So there are actually some rules that sometimes parents are not allowed to be organ donors, live organ donors for their children. Okay, so let's briefly go over that. We talked about it the last time, but some of you weren't here. What are the halachic issues in being a live organ donor? I want to donate a kidney, etc. Any particular problem? So the bottom line is that it's something you're allowed to do, and it might even be a mitzvah to do, but you are not obligated to do it, even if that'll mean that the person's going to die and you're the only one. And the theory behind that is the following. Although saving a life is certainly the highest mitzvah, but you're not obligated to save a life, anybody's life, if you're going to put your own life in potential danger. And the poskim have said that giving an organ, even though it's true that a person can live with one kidney, but at a minimum, you're putting yourself at a certain measure of risk, a certain measure of danger, and there is no obligation to save Reuven's life at the risk of putting your own life in danger. Now I say there's no obligation. Are you allowed to? So it actually says you are allowed to, and in fact, especially if the recipient is a worthy person, like a great Talmud Chacham or whatever it would be, it would even be a mitzvah to do so. But even if, you know, you're a drug addict, you know, whose life seems to have no apparent value, and the other person is the greatest tzaddik in the world, you are not obligated to risk your life to save somebody else. Right? That is the halachic idea, because you never know. You, as strange as it sounds, you never really know whose life is considered to be more valuable. But Forcho has infinitely complicated cheshbonos. At the same time, we do recognize the idea of voluntary martyrdom. A person can give his life to save another person. And there are times in which you are obligated. I mean, let's consider, for example, the problem of the soldier or the fireman or the policeman. Now, by definition, they will all, right? They'll always, or not always, but very often, put their lives in danger to save another person. And although I think it's true that nobody is obligated to become a policeman or a fireman, but once they've assumed that responsibility, they have in effect agreed to take on those risks. It's not so clear halakhically, well, why does that agreement make a difference? But nevertheless, the poskim have said that the assumption of that responsibility does create a responsibility, but if you're not in that situation, you're not obligated because of the danger factor. Now, so essentially, if you were to ask a rabbi, should I give a kidney? The rabbi's answer would be, you're not obligated, but you are permitted to, and then, of course, in a way, that makes it a more difficult decision, you see. If a rabbi were to tell you, you cannot, so that's your answer. If a rabbi were to tell you, you must, that's your answer. When the rabbi tells you, when the halacha tells you, you don't have to, but you can, that is actually a much harder question, because then you're going to have to grapple with it. And it really depends on everything else that's going on in your life. For example, if you're a mother with young children, you would probably be advised not to do it, because you would be affecting possibly, other members of your family. If you're single and unattached, perhaps there's more of a justification. You know, so it would depend very much on the individual, facts. Now, I know I don't want to elaborate on this too much because we did cover it, but I do want to, with apologies to those who heard this, I do just want to mention the Ayala case that I talked about the other week, because it is very, very fascinating. Again, apologies for the repeat. I'll try to be quick. There was a case around 20 years ago, and they made a movie out of this, and it was a book, and it was on television. and this involved non-Jewish people, about teenage girl that had leukemia, and she needed a bone marrow transplant, and there was no compatible donor on the registry, and the parents were not compatible, but the parents thought, let's conceive a new baby, and when the new baby is born, perhaps, the new baby will be a compatible donor for the bone marrow. I don't know what it was called, but that's the story. Now, this was an amazing story for a lot of reasons. Number one, dad had just had a surgical vasectomy, which means he couldn't have kids unless it got reversed, and the reversal is only around 40% of the cases. It's reversible. Number two, mom was over 40, which pregnancy chances plummet. Number three, mom was undergoing chemotherapy for breast cancer, which had to be discontinued. She had to be in remission and had to be discontinued in order for a pregnancy to occur. And number four, you know, even if they had a kid, who says neither parent was a compatible donor, who says the child would be? And yet, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was kind to them. The vasectomy was reversed. Mom went into remission. She cleaned the chemo out of her system. She got pregnant, and lo and behold, the miracle baby, little Marissa, was a 100% compatible match to big sister Anissa. And as a result, they were able to take bone marrow from the newborn baby, and I think, you know, 15... No, this is a story. This is a true story. No, but I'm telling you what I'm telling you is the real story, huh?
So I
want to discuss this. I just want to put out the case, and then we'll discuss the problem. So at the time, in the New York Times and Newsweek and Time Magazine and all sorts of professional journals as well, people were raising the ethical dilemma, so-called, of creating a child for the sole purpose of using that child as a bone marrow donor to save the other child. Now, again, one has to be careful. It's not like, you know, they took out the marrow and then threw her into the garbage. You know, she was raised and loved, etc. And the funny thing is, maybe the tragic thing is, that if somehow they would have aborted the child, that would be totally okay, because abortion is the 614th mitzvah in the Torah of American society. Thou shalt have an abortion if you want. So it's interesting that in some ways people were more concerned about the fact that the child was born than if the child would have been aborted. But I'll get to your problem in a moment. Now, that's case one. So this is the family happened to be Ayala. They were, you know, Hispanic, not Jewish. And they went ahead and they were able miraculously to get the marrow from the newborn to keep the baby, to keep the older sister alive. Now, case number two happened in Israel. Case number two involved a teenage boy who needed a kidney transplant. And once again, for all organ donations, you need a genetically compatible donor because the body rejects foreign tissue. Like, that's why transplants often fail. Rejection is a great thing for, right? I mean, it's a tremendous thing. That's how we ward off disease. But on the other hand, it also means when some foreign organ is introduced, it gets attacked. So you need to have as close a genetic match as is possible. And the closest match was a younger sibling. I don't remember the exact age, but we'll make up the age. Let's say he was 11. And the 11-year-old wanted to donate a kidney, and the parents wanted him to donate a kidney. But they were a religious family, and they asked the Shaila, and this is what the psak that they got. And we'll see if you think this is correct. The psak they got was, since there's no halachic obligation to donate a kidney, it is only based on your consent, because you're putting yourself at a certain risk, a minor does not have the power to consent to put himself into danger. And the parents cannot consent on his behalf, because the right of parents to consent for medical treatment to their children is only if it is for the benefit of the child. So I get consent that my child should have an operation, but I can't consent that my child should be an organ donor to save another child, because that is not for the best interest of the child, that is for the best interest of another child. So the psak halacha there was that The 11-year-old cannot be an organ donor. And I believe that, if I remember, the story had a very, very sad ending, that his older brother did die as a result of not having a compatible kidney donor. So the question that I want you to ponder, just in terms of, no, again, the Ayalas didn't ask a rabbi, and there was no halachic discussion there. But here's the thing. If halacha says 11-year-old cannot donate a kidney, then would halacha say a newborn baby could be used for the extraction of bone marrow? I mean, if even the 11-year-old can't agree to it, why would the, and the baby obviously didn't agree either, they just took it from the baby. Would there be a justification? You know, let's put it another way. What would the halacha be in the Ayala case if there were two Jews and they were asking a question? Would we be permitted to extract bone marrow from a baby to save the life of an older sibling? And the distinction in these halachic terms, I will see, maybe the distinction is not empirically correct, but the theoretical distinction is that removal of a kidney is said to be a life-threatening event, because although a person can certainly live with one kidney, but there's a much higher risk for kidney failure. Removal of bone marrow, by and large, and again, this may depend, by and large, although it is painful, it does create pain, but by and large, the only significant risk is general anesthesia, which might be considerable for a newborn baby. Even an extra drop of whatever can affect the baby, but the risks are extremely low. So the concept is this. You can't force a person to endanger their lives to save another person, and a child, even if he agrees, is not considered to be capable of consent. But when it's something that is less than a risk to life, in other words, it's not a risk to life, then indeed it can be compelled from the child, even without their consent. That would be the distinction. Now, that's a theoretical distinction. Now, whether that's a justifiable distinction in this case is very, very questionable. One could argue, for example, that allowing an 11-year-old to be an organ donor to an older sibling is not simply for the benefit of the older sibling. It is also for the benefit of the child. And this is true in two ways. Number one, he has a brother. Right. And number two, he is spared the overwhelming feeling of psychological guilt,
right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That he could have saved his brother's life. I mean, that is something that can actually affect a person. So the characterization of this operation as being only for the benefit of the other and not for the benefit of the minor, one might argue with that. But the theoretical halachic structure is true, that anything that involves an endangerment to you requires your consent, and a minor is not capable of consent. Of course, what makes it a little easier is, what's the definition of a minor in halacha, right? In other words, in halacha, you're an adult. A girl is an adult at the age of 12, and a boy is an adult at the age of 13. So it's much less. It's not 18 or 21 or anything like that. But still, if the kid is 11, halachically he would be a minor and would not be able to consent to the organ donation. Right, so that's kind of what you need to know about live organ donation, which basically means you are allowed to do it, if you're an adult at least, but it is not an obligation because of the risk factors that are involved. Now, the second category is the polar extreme, and that is what I will call cadaveric organ donations. In other words, I'm specifically not talking about the biggies, heart and livers yet, because those are in between. Mm-hmm. Cadaveric means the body is cold. The body is ready to go into the ground. It's in the funeral home already.
Right.
Now, the thing to know about cadaveric organ donations is that things like hearts and livers cannot be transplanted from a dead body because the heart tissue deteriorates very, very rapidly. That's why they're going to be the intermediate case, where that's the big discussion. So a lot of the big transplants, the major transplants, cannot be done from bodies in a cadaveric state. But there are a few things that can work from cadavers, real dead bodies, bodies that are cold to the touch, bodies that are in the morgue already, primarily skin, because skin does last for a while, and corneas, and corneas of eyes. They can be taken from the truly dead. So the question becomes, the reason I say truly, because you'll see heart transplants is an intermediate status of brain death, which is very complicated. But cadavers are truly dead. Now, what do you need to know about cadavers? Well, one thing to know is that halacha has many, many laws regarding the respect that one must treat even a dead body. Now, it's important that you put it in perspective. Why do we treat dead bodies with respect? Not because Judaism is a cult of the dead, like the Egyptians. It's exactly the opposite. It's exactly the opposite. We treat a body with a certain amount of respect because it once was the repository of the godly soul. And just like the cover, the mantle of a Sefer Torah has to be treated with respect because it once housed the Sefer Torah, so even the bare physical body has to be treated with respect because it once housed the godly soul. Now, the reason why this is important to make this point is sometimes you find that people have an exaggerated sense of reverence for the dead, which they don't show for people who are alive. So you'll hear this statement, "Don't speak evil of the dead," meaning, when you're alive, I can say what I want about you. Once you're dead, I got to respect you. It's exactly the opposite. We do respect the dead body only because of the greatness of the soul that was there when the person was alive. So if you respect the dead, kal vachomer, how much more so? You have to have respect for people who are alive. But this is a generic category called in Hebrew, kavod hames, honor of the dead. And this involves a whole bunch of things. Number one, it's axiomatic that a body has to be buried below the ground, not in a mausoleum. And halacha does prohibit cremation. Now, this is tricky. Obviously, people who were cremated against their will, like God forbid in the Holocaust, there's no sin there whatsoever. I mean, obviously in God, they will, of course, get the full share in the world to come. But voluntary cremation, somebody says, "I want to be cremated," is a very, very serious sin. And sometimes, we'll be faced with family members that will ask us to have them cremated. And what I tell people, I hope this will not shock you and don't walk out until the break, but what I tell people is, if your relative is very, very insistent that you agree to a cremation, agree to it. You don't have to agitate them, and then disregard their dying wishes, because if you can. Whoa. And the reason is, because I can assure you, if we believe in the soul, once they're dead and their soul is separated, the soul of Hashem, the soul will be very, very happy that you disregarded what they asked for. Now, I know people are very shocked to say, "You mean you lie to somebody on their deathbed?" Well, you can have a choice. You can tell them the truth, but that might upset them, and maybe it's not the time to upset them. So, So the point is, there is nothing improper with doing the right thing, even though you said you would do the wrong thing. Okay, I mean, you're doing the right thing. You're doing the good thing. And therefore, it is a proper activity to do. Now, there will be a lot of problems. I'm not, if anyone has a particular question, privately, I'd be happy to discuss it. Because very often, there'll be other siblings around. Let's say it's a parent. A parent requests cremation. Now, if you're the only child, okay. Or there's no spouse, let's say. Or you can do what you want. You can make the decision, and that's going to be fine. But the problem is going to be if one child is religious, the other siblings are not religious, the other siblings want to do the cremation, you don't want to do the cremation, that's very, very difficult to navigate. There are going to be times where it's beyond your control and you just won't be able to do anything. But cremation is an example of something that, at least in the abstract, halacha very, very strongly condemns. Another issue that's controversial, this is part of Kavod HaMeis, is halacha is normally against autopsies. Mm-hmm. Now, In the United States, every state has a different rule about when they do an autopsy and when they don't. And even Israel for many years, Israel now is not so much of a problem. But in the 1970s, this was a major problem. Virtually every death in Hadassah Hospital was subject to an autopsy. And the religious population was enraged, and more than once, they were stealing bodies in the middle of the night. They would dress up. They would dress up as doctors, put on white coats, and come in, or morgue attendants, and they would just like take the bodies out of the hospital. It was a big, big thing in Israel in the 1970s. But all right, now the law is not so strict. But sometimes in the United States, autopsies are compulsory. If somebody dies under suspicious conditions, you know, maybe it was a murder or something like that, you know, there may be a mandatory autopsy. I'll discuss, are there exceptions, but the general rule is, of course, that we don't like autopsies because the Torah wants every part of the body to be buried, and we don't want, you know, body parts to be removed. It is not kavod hames, it is called the desecration of the corpse to cut into it. And the like. A little aside, what about amputated limbs, generally? This is a question some people sometimes ask. Let's say, you know, God forbid, somebody had an amputated limb, you know, a gangrenous, diabetes, or something like that. So here's an interesting point. According to halacha, there is no requirement that a limb that was amputated when the person is alive be buried with the rest of the body. You know, it should be buried, but it doesn't have to be rejoined, so to speak. The laws of autopsy that you have to bury everything together is only what the person had when he died, so to speak. Whatever was removed when he was alive, theoretically, does not have to be buried back with him. So you don't have to keep a record like, where is that arm, or whatever it is. Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's terrible.
So you're right.
The whole purpose of burying the whole body together.
Right, right. So the question was raised, well, wait a second here. What about the resurrection of the dead, Techiyas HaMesim, if a person doesn't have his arm, doesn't have his leg? No, but the short answer is that Techiyas HaMesim, either way, is a miraculous process because most bodies are going to be totally decomposed into dust anyway, right? So just like the Holocaust victims, we have to assume that the Derech Nes, Hashem is going, if it's a miracle, Hashem is going to give everything back. So we paskin that way even by severed limbs.
Why is it that he's capable of raising the dead and regenerating the limbs of people who had them amputated, but he's not okay with people who are dust in a jar?
So the answer is, you're 100% correct. The problem of cremation is not that God will not be able to resurrect the dead, but God will choose not to because you did a voluntary act implying that you reject the concept of resurrection. Meaning the point is not that Hashem is disabled. The point is what you did, your statement, your implication that the body is not going to survive. You see, in other words, that's why if it's an involuntary cremation or even somebody died in a fire, you know, you wouldn't have that problem at all. Okay. Now, by autopsies, we do have certain rules. There was a very, very famous rabbi. Perhaps you heard of him. He lived around 250 years ago. He was the chief rabbi of Prague, Rabbi Yecheskel Landau. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's called the Noda B'Yehuda. Great, great rabbi, great posek. In fact, somebody wrote a biography of him called the Super Rabbi, whatever. He was one of the great rabbis. I still remember, just as an aside, apropos of nothing, but it reminds me of this. You know, when Hitler, during the Holocaust, was convinced that he would destroy the whole Jewish nation, and he was convinced there would be no Jews around. But he felt bad about that. Why did he feel bad about that? Because nobody would know the great nation that he destroyed. They're not going to even know. He's going to say, or whatever, his successors are going to say, we destroyed the Jews. Who are the Jews? No such people. So what he did was, imagine this, what he did was, he created a giant museum in Prague of Hitler, yes, of Jewish artifacts. He collected paintings and Kiddush cups and silver and Jewish books, a whole huge museum. And this was to be the museum of the extinct people, so he could show the world what he destroyed. And now, of course, Baruch Hashem, he was not, I mean, although he did tremendous damage to us, but he was not successful, but the museum was still there. I mean, so around, I guess around 25 years ago or so, it came to Washington, D.C., where I was living, and the Smithsonian sponsored an exhibition of the precious legacy. So I went to see it years ago. But this was Hitler's Jewish Museum, all sorts of interesting things. And, you know, most of it, though, wasn't for me, wasn't that interesting. You know, it was Kiddush cups, Havdalah cups. You know, you see one Kiddush cup, you see them all. But as I walked by, my eye was attracted to just a little notebook, you know, something like that, except it was yellowed. And nobody paid any attention to it. A notebook, you know, a notebook, what is it? But I looked. This was the original manuscript of Rabbi Yecheskel Landau's responsa and Talmudic interpretations.
What?
Now, again, for someone who studied in yeshiva, that was just a phenomenal, people didn't even know what it was. But I'll tell you, that was by far the most important thing in the exhibit. But anyway, I'm bringing this up because Rabbi Yecheskel Landau did author the great, great responsa about autopsies. And Rabbi Yecheskel Landau gives the following ruling. He says, yes, it is normally forbidden to do autopsies. That's true. But since you're not killing somebody, you're just desecrating a corpse, if the autopsy can save a life, so the same way, think about it this way, the same way we violate Shabbos to save a life, actually it's not a violation, we violate Kashrus to save a life, we violate Yom Kippur to save a life, we violate autopsies to save a life. In other words, autopsies are not murder. You can't murder somebody to save somebody else. But an autopsy is not murder. It's just a desecration of a corpse. And therefore, the Nei Rabbi Yehuda says, if it could save a life, it would be permitted. But, he then gives you a big limitation. Saving a life means that there's an actual person who can benefit. Meaning, if all you're doing is general medical research that in the long run may help you, but it's not for a transplant, or it's not for even forensic identification. He actually gave an example. If somebody was a victim of murder, and you want to do the autopsy to get evidence, that's called forensic autopsies, get evidence to convict somebody, he says that's permitted because people who murder are likely to murder again, so you're actually saving lives. So on one hand, the Nei Rabbi Yehuda does give us the green light for autopsies to save lives, but he does differentiate between, you know, something that'll be actually a life that you'll actually purchase versus a long-term medical benefit. Because you can never use that, because once you start talking about long-term benefits, it's too speculative. That's like saying, you know, a guy is in medical school, a man or a woman is in medical school. So they want to drive to hear a lecture on cardiology on Shabbos, because maybe this lecture will give them information that 10 years down the road, they'll be able to save somebody's life. So, hey, I can drive because it's Pikuach Nefesh. Right? In other words, that's not enough of a connection, you see? So that's his ruling about autopsies. So based on this idea, we have the following. I'm zipping back to organ donation. So in the case of cadaveric organ donation, you're normally not supposed to cut into a body and take things away. But you're allowed to do so if you are potentially saving a life. So here's the question. Is a cornea transplant, when I take a cornea off a dead body, autopsies are forbidden unless I am potentially saving a life. Is a corneal transplant considered to be a life-saving operation?
No.
Well, you could argue this. You could argue this two ways. You could say, "Well, listen, blindness is not death, so the difference between seeing and blind may not be life-threatening." On the other hand, some poskim have said that people who are blind do face certain risks to their life that seeing people don't face, such as getting hit by a car because you didn't see the car coming. Of course, in Eretz Yisrael, I think you're equally at risk whether you can see or not. In fact, you've noticed, by the way, that at the intersections here, we do have things for blind. The ticker.
I still wouldn't like to be blind, especially.
No. Of course, nobody wants to be blind. But what I'm saying is, listen, blindness is an awful, awful thing. Of course it is. In fact, there's something that people tell me about. I have not been there myself. But they tell me you have to do this.
Yeah,
this is Museum of the Blind. Did you go?
Yeah,
go
I've been to that.
It's so
very cool.
Yeah, they say it's an amazing thing.
Very amazing.
It's a good experience. It's amazing.
But I understand, I mean, listen, we all understand that blindness is an awful, awful thing, but the halachic question is it a pikuach nefesh situation?
Mm-hmm.
right? So Postcum or Makel? Postcum are actually lenient. Postcum basically say that corneal transplants are potentially life-saving because blindness is a life-threatening condition in many cases. So even though it involves autopsy, it is going to be permitted. On the other hand, if you're donating your corneas for, let's say, general medical research in a laboratory, you would, right, whatever, they'll do whatever it is, testing on it, that would not be allowed. Now, skin is the same thing. Skin is part of your body, obviously. In fact, skin is an organ, technically. Skin is an organ. It's the largest organ of the body. It covers you entirely. Now, skin is salvageable, even from a cadaver, up to a certain amount of time, because the cells are still alive, even if the body as a whole is not. So the question is, though, is removal of the skin a violation of the autopsy rule? So once again, it would depend on whether it's a life-saving procedure or not. So that would depend. If the skin is going to go to a burn victim who might die, that would be considered permissible. If the skin is going to go to someone's cosmetic, purely cosmetic surgery, that would be an example where you would not be permitted. So that would mean, in a sense, if you fill out a consent form ahead of time that, you know, you want your skin to go for this, you would have to target, halakhically, you would have to specify that it go to patients who are in a dangerous condition or the like. So the bottom line is that cadaveric organ donations are permitted, provided they involve what are called pikuach nefesh situations. And then they'll have a discussion what is called a pikuach nefesh situation. Now, there is one complication here, though. There is one complication, and this is, maybe I'm not sure if I should, well, I'll mention it because I'd like to be honest with you, and that is, pikuach nefesh has a certain complication that many people find is the most difficult halakha in Judaism, and that is, pikuach nefesh applies to saving Jews. It actually does not apply technically to saving goyim. By that I mean the following. The Gemara in Maseches Yuma, this is the tractate about the laws of Yom Kippur, discusses the following situation. Let's say a wall or a building collapsed on top of people. And in order to try to save them, you don't know if they're dead or alive, but they might be alive, right? Even if there's a 1 out of 1,000 chance they're alive, you got to violate Shabbos and bring in the bulldozers and bring in everything else to save them. But let's say you knew for sure, I'm just quoting the Gemara, and I'll tell you how we get around this. If you knew for sure that the people who were trapped under the rubble were non-Jews, you would not be allowed to desecrate the... Now, during the week, you'd save a non-Jew also. I know, I shouldn't have said it. Okay, but I'll go over this a little bit, just to make it a little more palatable. Now, again, be sure you understand the context. During the week, you don't differentiate. During the week, you'll save a Jew and a non-Jew. This is a special rule for Shabbos and Yom Kippur. In other words, you're not allowed to violate Shabbos and Yom Kippur to save a non-Jew, only to save a Jew. Now, many have said, including some great rabbis, that they find this almost the most difficult halacha to try to understand, because after all, we do believe, Judaism does believe, that all human beings are made in the image of God. Now, it's true, the special divine soul might be uniquely to the Jew, but being made in the image of God applies to everybody. This is, in fact, the old expression that some people hate, but I don't find it that bad, the Judeo-Christian ethic. I mean, Christianity got it from Judaism. It's the notion of the dignity of man, of human beings, the sanctity of human life. This is the fact that all human beings are made in the image of God. So it seems to be inconsistent that all human beings are made in the image of God, Jew and non-Jew, and yet we are not allowed to desecrate the Shabbos, according to the Gemara's law, in order to save the non-Jew. We're only allowed to desecrate the Shabbos, and we're commanded to desecrate to save the Jew. Well, what about the idea that all human beings are made in the image of God? One way of understanding it is that it's not so much that the non-Jew's life is less important as it is that Shabbos can be violated only for those that have the mitzvah of Shabbos. Now, there's an expression, violate one Shabbos in order that you should have many Shabboses in the future, meaning keep somebody alive, right? So maybe it only applies when the person has the mitzvah of Shabbos. Now, even if the Jew is not religious, he's not going to keep Shabbos, but still, there's that potential. So people ask me, well, the non-Jew might convert. Well, that's a separate thing. Converting, you become another person, but the non-Jew doesn't have Shabbos. So it's hard to understand. Now, I will tell you this. Practically, halacha works its way around it, although that doesn't resolve the moral dilemma. I mean, let's take practically. A non-Jew, forget about the issue of Arab, and it's a separate issue, terrorists, whatever it is, but a non-Jew has a heart attack in front of me on Shabbos. I have a cell phone. Well, actually, how would I have a cell phone? But let's say it's not, yeah, I wouldn't have a cell phone, but let's say it's right next to my house. I could call 911, but picking up the telephone is committing a Shabbos violation. So what's the halacha? I let him die because I'm not supposed to pick up the telephone? Well, if you read the Gemara literally, the answer is yes. But here is what the halacha develops. Halacha develops the idea. Now again, it's a way out, but it doesn't answer the ethical problem. And that is, if you don't save a non-Jew when the non-Jew is in danger, that will create hatred and incitement against the Jewish people. So ultimately, the Jewish people are going to be endangered by the hatred that you've created by not helping a non-Jew. So as a result, every pikuach nefesh to a goy becomes pikuach nefesh to the Jew. And therefore, so the bottom line is, practically, therefore, you can call 911. Practically, you can call the ambulance. So practically, there's not going to be a big distinction between a Jew and a goy.
Your neighbor's dog is not your favorite.
Say again? I didn't hear you. Say, huh? Yeah.
If you don't like the neighbor's dog, then you can just let it die.
Well, that's for sure. No. But, one second. Let the dog die or let the neighbor die?
Let the neighbor die.
Oh, no, yeah. No. I meant the dog, I mean, that even your own dog, you know, God forbid, I know people are attached to their pets, and I understand that. But, I mean, let me just emphasize, you cannot desecrate the Shabbos to save animals.
Is this a really broadly accepted...
Yes. Now, what you're allowed to do is you're allowed to move muksa to save an animal. Certain rabbinic laws.
No,
about the guy. Yeah. Yes, it is. It absolutely is.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is, we get around it by this principle of have hatred.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah,
that's what
yeah.
I'm saying. Would you say that's like a standard?
That is a standard. Yeah.
Response.
Yeah. Some people are stricter, and some people are less stricter. But that does mean theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
If you're on a desert island and it's just you and the guy, and no one's ever going to know.
Right. That's what I'm. Yeah.
Yeah. So. What rabbis have said about this, again, I'll be honest with you, they have said, well, this answers it as a practical matter, but it doesn't really answer it as an ethical matter, because you're still saying, well, I wouldn't save the guy, but I got to do it, because otherwise,
because
Jews...
That seems
yeah.
as speculative. You said it's a Gemara halakha?
Yes, it is a Mishnah. It's not just a Gemara. It's actually a Mishnah. It's based on the idea that the heter, the dispensation for violating the Torah to save a life, is based on the verse V'chai Bohem, you shall live by the Torah, and you shall not die by the Torah, right? I remember when I first heard that when I was like in sixth grade, I said, come on, that's kind of a joke. But that is the drasha. V'chai Bohem, you shall live and not die. And since V'chai Bohem is a pasuk that was said to the Jewish people, that dispensation only applies there. I'm sorry, you said something?
Oh, no, I was going to say, it seems just as speculative that this might breed hate with non-Jews as it is to say that the doctor shouldn't look at your organ under the microscope because he might not learn nothing.
Yeah, I understand. Now, of course, you know, yeah, I mean, today especially, you know, of course, in Talmudic times, you know, things are turbulent and... There could be a pogrom or anything else. You're correct. To apply it indiscriminately actually seems to be overly lenient, but at least operationally. In fact, a few years ago in Israel, a newspaper report, you know, Israel's press has a ongoing war against Orthodox, against maybe ultra-Orthodox Jews, you know, whatever they distort. And although I will admit that there are things that the Haredi community does that are not always so good, like, you know, knocking a woman out of her seat on a bus, okay, and that's not good. But on the other hand, a lot of what the newspapers report are just lies. And I will tell you, around 10 years ago, they actually reported that a non-Jew in Bnei Brak suffered a heart attack in front of hundreds of religious Jews on Shabbos, and nobody did anything to save him, and as a result, he died, and nobody cared. This is what was reported. And it was discovered, and of course, people got outraged. It was discovered the whole thing was a lie. It didn't happen. And as I say, although theoretically it should have happened, according to the Mishnah, that seems to be the law. It should have, you know, there's according to the Mishnah, but as I say, halachically we work around it, and practically we will save the non-Jew as well. Yeah.
So technically, couldn't the 11-year-old have saved his brother, because like the non-Jews would have been like, whoa, he's not saving his brother, like, and create hatred against Jews?
Well, that's a good point. On the other hand, keep in mind that the very fact that he's only 11 means he's not yet obligated in all of those commandments, so he doesn't have the obligation to take that take those steps. Also, I would say, too, I don't think it would shock the non-Jews, because I'll tell you the truth. I believe even under American law, under secular law, I believe in most states, a minor cannot give an organ. So, you know, in a sense, the halacha is not doing something that's outrageous in the eyes of
the
nation.
Consent.
I'm not sure. I believe that may not be the case. I believe that exactly for the halachic reason, that parents cannot consent to a removal of an organ from the minor unless the minor needs it medically, like it's cancerous or something like that. So it's a similar thing.
About kidneys?
Okay.
Yeah. No. I mean, about whether... I think that you probably wouldn't.
You would not.
From a child, but I actually don't know.
Yeah, but I believe
if it was
here.
Illegal to watch somebody die from a heart attack and not call, then would you have to call?
Well,
then you're up for murder or at least manslaughter.
Well, then you get into a general issue of the law of the land is law, meaning Jews are supposed to obey the law of the land. However, let me point out, as far as I know, except in Vermont, that was a famous Seinfeld. But except in Vermont. There is no duty to rescue. This is one of the outstanding differences between Jewish law and secular law, and that is, under Jewish law, at least if I see a Jew in trouble, I am obligated to render affirmative assistance. Under secular law, there is no duty to rescue people. This goes back to a famous case way before you were born, Kitty Genovese, which is still like the prototype case of a woman that was murdered in a parking lot in Queens in the 1960s. And like hundreds of people saw it, and nobody called the police, and nobody called 911 or whatever the number was in those days. And in truth, you know, let's say you're a gold medal Olympic swimmer and you're walking by and a kid falls into a pond and you could easily rescue him, but you don't want to get your suit wet or whatever it is. You are not responsible. So I'm not aware of any law in the United States that would say that.
Doctors are different.
Yeah.
Stop if they see something.
Well, this may depend. You know, traditionally, even that wasn't the case. I remember reading an article by an intern who said that he felt what is the day that he really felt like a doctor? He says he was driving in the New Jersey Turnpike, and there was an accident, and the ambulance hadn't come yet, and he got out, and he did mouth-to-mouth, and he had an injection, he did all sorts of stuff with the guy, and he kept him alive till the EMTs, you know, came in, and he felt, now I'm a doctor. And he gets back to the hospital, and he tells the attending physician how proud he was, I saved a life today. So the attending physician is looking at him and saying, you know, you are nuts, you stopped? Do you realize that if you stopped and something went wrong, you know, you could be liable in the hospital? I don't know why the hospital could be liable. He goes, you don't stop unless it's your patient. You keep on going. And the person felt so deflated. He says, this is why I went to medical school. You know, this is why, you know, I became a doctor. So the truth of the matter is, under the classical secular law system, not only were you not obligated to stop, you were encouraged not to, because if something went a bit wrong, you could be have tremendous liability and the like. Now, many states did pass what are called Good Samaritan laws. Yeah. Now, the Good Samaritan law doesn't say you have to stop, but it does say that if you stopped and you did the best that you could, you will not be liable for damages or malpractice or anything like that. Now, once somebody is, so even a doctor does not have to stop, but once somebody is my patient, then there are all sorts of laws regarding my responsibility. But I don't have to assume that role. If doctor is in a Walmart or whatever it would be, he doesn't have to be a doctor in Walmart. Yeah.
What if you had no way of knowing whether the person was a Jew or not?
Okay, if there's any possible doubt, you go ahead and violate the Shabbos. It's only if you knew for sure. And that's an interesting question. You really never know for sure. Because names don't mean anything. Names do not mean anything at all. You know the old story about the Hasidic Yid who lived in New York, and his name was Sean Ferguson. Missouri. This is an old Borscht Belt joke, you know. So somebody asked, well, how does a Hasidic Jew from Poland get the name Sean Ferguson? You know, that's kind of an Irish name. So he says, well, I went to Ellis Island and I gave my name as, you know, Kontrovichka, whatever it would be, and the border patrol asked me, how do you spell the name? And I said, Schein Vergessen. Now, Schein Vergessen in Yiddish means I've forgotten already. So he puts down Sean Ferguson.
Also, it could be a Gare. Like
that's correct. That's correct. So actually, you have a very good point. Your point basically is that
you never know,
and therefore that's another reason why you do it. You're 100% correct. If there's any doubt whatsoever, but so maybe it's more of a theoretical, but theoretically, if you knew, the halacha would be you would not be allowed to unless we have the idea that it would generate hatred. Now, coming back to organ donation, the reason why I'm bringing all of this up is, what did I say? I said that according to Rabbi Yechezkel Lando, the Knight of Yehuda, you're allowed to take skin and corneas if it will save a life. Well, what if it will save a non-Jewish life as opposed to a Jewish life? Are we going to allow you to violate the autopsy rules for the pikuach nefesh of goyim? Now here, it's a little tricky because it's on one hand, we could say, well, if somebody gets a heart attack and I don't save them, that's going to cause hatred to the Jews. On the other hand, if you don't give organs, that really doesn't cause hatred because most non-Jews don't give organs either. Organ donation is very, very low. The percentage of people who donate organs in the general population in the United States is under 20%. So if a Jew says, I'm not going to give organs because I don't want it to, you know, because he doesn't make a press conference, he doesn't put it on Facebook, I'm not going to give organs, I don't want to save non-Jewish lives. I mean, nobody's saying, put that statement there. But if you make a decision, I don't want to give an organ because it may result in autopsies benefiting non-Jews, that's not going to cause hatred or retaliation, because a lot of people don't give organs, right? So it's a bit of a question there, whether you'd have to target your organ donation. Theoretically, you could, but it would look very bad to say, I hereby donate my skin to only Jews. You know, you have to figure out how to do that in a diplomatic way. There actually are channels to do it that way, but that would create the problem of the targeted organ donation. So I've discussed two categories, and I've skirted the main one, which I'm going to get to now. I've discussed the live organ donor, and we discussed the cadaveric organ donor, but we still haven't hit the biggies, the heart and the liver transplants, which are really an intermediate stage, which gets us into the halachic issue, the most controversial halachic issue, of brain death, brain stem death, and the like.
Going to say is that in like cadaver donation, like, because you donate, you usually don't target who you're donating it to.
That's correct.
There's a chance that it's going to save a Jew, so it's.
So you're saying the chance itself would justify it?
Yeah.
Yeah. No? Okay. That makes sense. If it may, now there's the same argument. You don't know who's under the building.
Exactly.
Could apply to the donation as well. Yeah. So that's a good point. Yeah.
So at the DMV, you can put yes. Organ donor.
Okay, now one second. You can't answer that till I get to the next topic, because you can say yes to cadaveric organ donations, but remember, the heart and the liver are going to be governed by a different standard, and that's going to be, right, so you can't, don't fill out that driver's license till you hear the rest of the class. Be sure, okay. So I want to collect all driver's licenses and be sure that nobody, yeah.
So I don't know if you want to like answer this now or later, yeah. But like I'm just curious about the like perspective on all of this from the point of view of like a Jewish doctor. Like, can they perform these operations? Can they do the autopsies?
The short answer is that the prohibition is more on the doctor than the patient. In other words, like this: if the prohibition is the autopsy, the removal, technically, it's not the patient, it's not the donor that's committing the sin. It is the doctor that's committing the sin. So in many ways, the doctor has a greater responsibility than even the patient. The patient, or not the patient, I mean the donor. The donor is just giving permission. It is the doctor that's doing the actual sin.
Because there's also, like, medical students who have to, like, they're obligated to do, you know, like, corpse
dissection. Well, that's a very good question. In fact, that's a general question. Forget about organ donation. Corpse dissection. Okay, so many of you in high school, although I managed to escape this, probably dissected frogs or other things. That's what they used to do. I don't know if they still do it anymore. don't have to be more civilized high school. But
different country.
Okay. But the thing is, medical students commonly learned anatomy on actual human bodies. People donated their bodies to science. Yeah. Now, halakha clearly says you cannot donate your body to science, because that's the Neid of Yehuda's Pesach, that it's only when it will go to actual therapeutic uses that is permitted, and not general scientific knowledge. So clearly, you're not allowed to donate your body to science, and by extension, the physicians, if they're Jewish at least, would have a prohibition to cut into the bodies and everything else. That is a very, very severe halachic problem. Again, some say, well, if it's a non-Jewish cadaver, perhaps you could be lenient. But in truth, a religious Jew should seek an exemption. And the truth is, today it's much easier to get an exemption because of computer modeling, although it's not so complete, because of the very, very sophisticated imaging that we have, there's actually less need for live bodies than there used to be. Again, I'm not totally familiar with what's going on in the medical schools, but there is actually a movement away from live bodies. Although, logically, it seems to me nothing can beat a live body. It just seems to me. I don't mean a live body, it's a dead body. Nothing can beat a real body, as it were. But still, maybe for money, maybe for storage purposes, or whatever it is, they're trying to move away with the simulators. Just like the way they train pilots, right? They train pilots with simulators. Okay. Although I remember with the 9/11 pilots, again, apropos of nothing, the claim is they should have been suspicious because they didn't want to take the courses on landing. Somebody signs up to a flight school and wants to skip the landing courses, and I get a little, that should trigger some suspicion. Okay, whatever. Okay. Yeah, okay. All right. You flunked landing. Okay. Anyway. So now I want to get to the real. So actually everything that I said is preliminary to the guts of the real, real problem. And that is, let us come now to really the most important transplants. Well, kidneys are very important, but heart transplants, liver transplants, these are major. Heart transplants started in my own lifetime. I remember the first heart transplant was 1967, 68. Dr. Christian Barnard, a cardiosurgeon in South Africa, in Cape Town, did the first heart transplant. And initially, heart transplants, the truth of the matter is, the recipients died more quickly than they would without the operation. Let's say without the operation, they would live for a week. They were hanging on for a week. Typically, they died like on the operating table, whatever it is. So it was a gamble. And typically, they actually died faster than they would even without the transplant. But Baruch Hashem, you know, there is a learning curve in this technology. And right now, people with heart transplants can survive 5 years, 10 years, even longer than that. Liver transplants have a similar good history. Again, sometimes people do die right away, or a short time, but people do have long-term survival. Now, what is the problem with a heart transplant? The problem is the following, that the heart muscle deteriorates very, very rapidly once there is no longer an oxygen supply. So if you were to wait until somebody dies in a classical sense, they're a cadaver, you would not be able to use the heart for transplantation because the heart muscle deteriorates in a matter of a few minutes, maybe 5-10 minutes, you know, after death, whatever death means, right? So the problem basically is that heart transplants back in the 60s raised a philosophical dilemma. Because if you wait until the person's dead, in classical terms, and I'll talk about what that is, the heart is not suitable. On the other hand, to cut into a person while he's alive looks like barbarism, like you're murdering somebody to save somebody else. So how do you get around that? So the way the system got around it was redefining the concept of death. In other words, it answers an ethical problem by definitional, ledger domain, meaning the following. In fact, somebody once said this would be a solution to handicapped newborns, right? There was a question about sometimes children are born with severe handicaps, but once they're born, you can't have abortion, right? It's infanticide. So what do you do about defective newborns? So James Watson, the co-founder of DNA, suggested, why don't we just redefine birth? Birth occurs 72 hours after emergence from the womb. So that means, in other words, that if you kill a baby within the first 3 days of birth, it's only a late-term abortion. We'll call it a postpartum abortion.
Sounds like a joke.
Watson, Watson and Crick?
Well, like, Watson and Crick, yeah.
It's a joke, right? This is...
Well, at some point, I'm not sure. I think he... Okay.
Who said that?
Watson, James Watson. Now, here's the thing. Let me explain this. What is... Let's first talk about legal definitions, then we'll talk about halakhic definitions, okay? Okay, be sure you have your two hats on, because I'm now talking about a secular definition, and then I'll move to a halakhic definition. If you would have looked in a medical dictionary 50 years ago, or a legal dictionary 50 years ago, death, what is death? You would find the following definition. Death is the clinical state that occurs when there is irreversible, cessation of respiratory and is important, circulatory functions. In other words, you're dead when you're no longer capable of breathing, and there is no longer heartbeat, pulse, and circulation of blood. Okay? You needed both conditions. You could not be declared, and of course they had to be irreversible, because if a person temporarily stops but could be resuscitated, they are not dead. But assuming it's irreversible, you needed an irreversible cessation of respiration and heartbeat, pulse, circulation. Okay, that's important, respiration and circulation. Now, until respirators or ventilators were invented, this was not a particular problem, because once you stopped breathing, your heart had no oxygen and it wouldn't beat and no blood would circulate either. So normally, for most of human history, if you lost one, you lost the other. But with the advent of the ventilator, we now have a very strange situation where the brain stem, which is the base of the brain that controls respiration, could in fact be destroyed and you could be incapable of breathing. But the heart has its own pacemaker. The heart is not directly controlled by the brain. As long as the heart muscle is getting oxygen, it can continue to pump and circulate blood. So a respirator-dependent patient may, in fact, have no autonomous respiratory capacity. May. I mean, some do, but theoretically, right? But because the oxygen is being delivered mechanically, the heart continues to pump. Now, under classical legal definition, that person was alive. And to take a heart from him in that state was murder. But starting in the 60s, there began to be a new definition of death, which no longer focused on circulation, pulse, and heartbeat, but it focused on capacity of respiration and brain stem activity. Now, again, and this is called brain death or brain stem death or whole brain death or cerebral death. It's given a lot of different terms, but it's very, extremely important that you understand the following distinction. A person in a typical coma, called a persistent vegetative state, is not, under any definition, brain dead. A person can lack consciousness. If you remember Terry Schiavo a few years ago? Mm-hmm. This was a young woman, again, tragically.
Yeah.
She was in a coma for 15 or so years. And then, she died because she was starved to death. Her husband petition to have her discontinued nutrition. Terry Schiavo was not brain dead. Terry Schiavo was not on a respirator. Terry Schiavo, in fact, was actually very healthy, other than the fact he was in a coma for 15 years. She was breathing on her own. If nutrition was delivered, she was digesting food and nutrients. So Terry Schiavo lacked higher mental consciousness, but her brain stem that controlled respiration was totally intact. Terry Schiavo was not brain dead. Even under secular law, if you took an organ from Terry Schiavo, that would have been murder. Brain stem death is a very different phenomenon. Brain stem death involves a clinical diagnosis that there is no activity controlled by the brain at all, including involuntary activities like respiration. And there's a whole bunch of ways you test for brain stem death. Number one, you test the ability of spontaneous respiration, no matter how small it is. You test neurologically, you jab like a needle in the arm, there's no response. You shine a light on the in the eyes, and the pupils do not dilate, etc. Basically, the person is dead, except for the fact that because of the respirator, the heart is beating, the blood is circulating, and therefore, because there's a perfusion of blood to the heart, we can now cut in and take that organ. And that's right. So the point I'm making is this. Modern heart transplants, with some exceptions I'll get to later, depend on brain death as your operating definition of death. Because if you were to wait until classical death, then you would not be able to transplant the organ at all. Mm-hmm. So one I think has to be a little ethically suspicious, that the redefinition of death comes into being the same time as we have the definition of the invention of heart transplants. It's almost as if you're redefining death in order to enable a procedure that you otherwise wouldn't be able to do under the older definition. Does everyone understand this? In other words, under the older definition of death, a heart transplant would be legally impossible because since the heart is beating and the blood is circulating, the patient hasn't died. Or not the patient, the donor hasn't died. If the donor hasn't died, you're murdering him. But by redefining death as clinical brain death, you have now said, hey, he's not alive, he's dead. As a result, I can remove his organs, at least if there's family consent and everything else. So in the United States, brain death, not the persistent vegetative state, brain death is the legal definition of death in all 50 states. All 50 states say, once there is a clinical diagnosis of brain death, that patient can be declared dead. Sometimes, in some states, that's even over the objections of the family. Notice the hospital may have the right to say, we're shutting off the respirator, even without an organ donation, because he's dead. We need the bed. Other states say that the family has the right to keep them. Again, I do want to point out one thing about brain death. Brain death will not result in a Terry Schiavo case, because a person could be in a persistent vegetative state for 20 years and maybe come out of it even, and maybe not come out of it. Brain death is not going to last forever, meaning from the time that there's a clinical diagnosis of brain death till final cardiac arrest will be no longer than 8 months. So there can be 8 months of lingering, although that's rare too, but we're not talking about years, because even though the heart is not controlled by the brain, but at some point when there's brain death, the pacemaker will eventually fail in and of itself. So people should not think that a brain dead patient, number one, can come out of it. Unless there's a mistake in diagnosis, you cannot come out of brain death.
I'll get to it.
You cannot come out of brain death unless the diagnosis was inaccurate, which sometimes it is. Sometimes it is. You need confirmation and double and triple. On the other hand, brain death is not a lingering condition. Okay, but nevertheless, legally, not halacha, I'll get to halacha in a moment. Legally, brain death is the definition of death, and it is the only way, subject to a certain exception I'll mention, it is the only way that heart transplants can be effectuated. Because if you were to wait until traditional, old-fashioned death, the heart would not be suitable for transplantation. Now, that is why the ideal organ donor The ideal organ donor is a healthy teenager who rode a motorcycle without a helmet. Because what we want to get, it's a little macabre, we want to get a healthy kid whose brain is totally smashed. But as a result, his internal organs are healthy. In fact, this may be a joke, a bad joke, but someone told to me as an actual serious argument that when a state legislature was debating whether to pass a helmet law for motorcycle riders, so somebody said that the organ donation lobby was against the helmet law because they said it would cut down the number of donors of organs because you'd have fewer. What can I tell you?
That's probably true.
You think it's true?
I used to work in the New York State Assembly and used to get stuff like that.
Okay. So you know. All right. Now,
one
of the things you learn is no matter how strange something sounds, it probably happens, you know, one way or the other. Okay.
Not surprised.
So everything, you know, everything is so interrelated that, you know, you try to be safe here and you're going to wind up with people dying because they couldn't get organs and the like. Okay, so now the $64,000 question is simply this. What is the halachic definition of death? Because this is critical. And here's the important thing. When you ask the average, even Orthodox Jew, why would halacha be against organ donors? So they'll tell you something like, well, you're not allowed to cut into a dead body. There's a resurrection of the dead problem. Not true. Because when it comes to saving a life, that is permitted, right? All the reasons that people commonly say are halachic problems of organ donation are not the halachic problem. The halachic problem is not that you're doing an autopsy. You might be committing murder. Because if halacha, in other words, when is a person dead according to halacha? If a brain-dead person is still alive because their heart is beating, the problem with taking out the heart is not an autopsy. It's a murder, and you can't kill one person to save another person. If, on the other hand, halacha would recognize brain death, then the person's dead. So to save a life, it would be permitted, like the Knight of Yehuda ruled, Rav Landau ruled, regarding autopsies. So this is very important. A lot of people are not going to get this right. The halachic problem, and I'll talk about how we address it, the halachic problem with organ donors, such as heart and liver, is not
Hold on.